Today's date is July 16th, 1997. The speaker is Jim DeLange. The subject is community. The title is Maintaining Community in the Context of Continual Grief.
Okay, how many of you been in a session with me before? Okay, well, I better reintroduce myself then. Okay. I'm Jim DeLange. I'm the senior pastor at St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco, where I have served for 16 years. our church is nearly 100, our congregation is nearly 100 years old. Before that, I was a church executive with one of the predecessor church bodies of the ELCA. And prior to that, I served for 14 years as a pastor of a suburban congregation in Huntington Beach, California. That's in Southern California. The topic we're going to be talking about today, as we have indicated on the board upstairs, is the whole subject of a congregation continued grief and loss. You can roll the tape now. Yeah, would you close the doors, Jack? Thanks. The news from northern Minnesota and North Dakota about the terrible losses that people have suffered in the floods there was something that was close to us. We suffered an earthquake in 1989 that did considerable damage to our church building. However, did not render it dysfunctional. We could still worship in it and so on. But it also brought to mind the grief and the loss that our congregation has suffered over the past years. The grief and loss that we have experienced has been due to AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, which is caused by the HIV virus, a virus that we think came from Africa, but we're not sure just exactly how it got here. And it got into the blood supply, and it got into the bloodstreams of a lot of people, including people who are hemophiliacs, people who had had blood transfusions because of operations at the particular time, and also among gay men, where blood was transmitted due to their sexual practices primarily. So AIDS is passed by blood primarily, and perhaps some think also by semen, but primarily it's blood, and it is a very fragile virus that you can't get by casual kind of contact or even kissing or anything like that. It's not easily transmitted. In 1981 in San Francisco and in New York, they began to see something that they called a gay cancer. And it was showing up with purplish, bruised type of marks on people's bodies. And people were dying very quickly after they had symptoms. Sometimes people would have trouble breathing, and within 3-4 days they were gone. It wasn't until the summer of 1981 that, which is exactly the time when I arrived in St. Francis, that the virus was isolated and they found out what it was that was causing this disease. Since that time, the people in San Francisco, we have suffered the loss of about 15,000 people. And it has been a terrible scourge on our community. And of course, it has hit also our congregation. Since 1982, 32 of our members have died, and countless friends, and we've asked sometimes, people over 40 will start making lists of friends of theirs that they have lost, and after 50, why they just don't want to do it anymore, after they make a list of all the people who have died. Some years in the middle 1980s, we lost 10% of our congregation to AIDS. And as I say, we've lost 15,000 people to the disease in San Francisco, and there are probably two or three times that many who are infected with the virus and living today. During the day in the Castro District, which is the center of the gay community in San Francisco, you would go up there and you would see all of these gaunt young men, some of them with canes, some of them in wheelchairs being wheeled by an attendant, going to a restaurant, sometimes with a very vacant look on their faces until you talk with them. You could just see the sense of kind of doom that was over the whole community. Now you don't see as many anymore because they're all dead. And new drugs and things like this have made a difference so that people they don't get to that stage in every case. Now one could say that those kinds of dynamics of having death around a lot and dealing with death and dying is the same kind of thing you would have in a senior center, where a senior home where you have a lot of elderly people. I think the difference is, for us who are seniors is that we have some perspective on this. We have lost our parents, we've lost our grandparents, we've lost our aunts and uncles. In some cases, we've even lost our own children. But we have seen, I think, as seniors, and especially if you are a person who are in your late 70s and 80s, you've seen a lot of death among your contemporaries, and you have some perspective on it. But when you're in your 30s, you don't have that perspective. And so it's kind of like people living in a war zone. It's that same kind of thing. These are young men who, in most cases, their parents are both still living. And sometimes their grandparents are still living. Death and dying is not supposed to be part of your community life when you are in your 30s. One of the young men in our church is 27 years old, and he died, and he spent the last couple of weeks at home with his parents in Phoenix, who were wonderful people, and we went to do his memorial service. And what do you say about a person 27 years old when you start to kind of recount their life? We had some of his high school achievements, and he had not gone to college and just started a career. And so there wasn't a whole lot to say because he didn't have a whole lot of history. And this young man died on Christmas Day. I'm trying to think of what year it was. I think it was 1993. What is that bell for?
That's the bus here to town.
Oh, the bus is the bus again. Okay. Now, as our congregation has had to deal with this, I wanted to say a few things about the way that we have responded to the disease and to the needs of the people who were there, who are in our congregation, many of whom are HIV positive, and many of whom are dying. Number one, we have just some practical kinds of things with our facility. We have hard pews. So what we did was we got a bunch of pillows, something like this, that are stacked in the back. They're a little thicker than these, so that people can that don't have much padding left back here can sit in church comfortably. Of course, people with AIDS are not the only ones who use these pillows. There are some others. And another thing we did is that we put in an elevator. Our church is on the second floor. In 1985, we put in an elevator and a ramp also to get into the lower floor of the building, so that people make the place handicap accessible. The other thing is that when we remodeled the church and did some refurbishing of the sanctuary in 1992, we made the pews up in the very front, half pews, so there are room for wheelchairs on both sides. And when it's time for communion, why, then the pastors just come down, and I mean, our people come up to the altar to receive communion and a kneeling rail, and then when it's time for communion, we go down and give folks communion. And I'm sure that a lot of congregations do that with senior citizens and others who are not physically able. Another thing that we do is that we have prayers of healing, personal prayers of healing every Sunday in every service. During the distribution of communion, people go to the rear of the church to the baptismal font, where the pastor, usually the one who is preached for the day, is in the back and does individual private prayer with the person and anointing of oil. Another thing that we have done is that, and this was especially, it's not so important now, but it was especially important in the early years of the disease, where people were very frightened of the transmission of this disease. And we learned enough about it to know that it wasn't easily transmitted. And that is that we use both the common cup at our church, and we also use individual glasses, just because some people prefer it that way. But most people drink out of the common cup and the common chalice. And what we as pastors, and there are four of us who are four pastors, and so what we do is that whoever is presiding, we commune last, and we take communion, we take a drink from the common cup, the last person to drink from it. And this was not only a matter of the fact that liturgically the host is supposed to, you know, receive last, like you would do, but also to make a statement, to let people know that this is not something that you have to be afraid of, and because some people were staying away from communion entirely. One of the other things that is among the pastors, we have found ourselves being not only pastors to the people who are dying, and having to visit in the hospital a lot or at home, and this is a kind of a disease that is very erratic. I could be visiting someone in the hospital on Wednesday, and they're hooked up to IVs and struggling to breathe and everything else like that, and you know, are wondering if they were going to make it. And the next Sunday they're in church. So you have this roller coaster all the time with this disease, both the person who has the disease and their partners and their families. It's just an up and down kind of thing. And the same with the caregivers. So you never know if one episode of hospitalization and getting on machines and everything else like that is going to be this episode is going to do the one that kills you, or it's just another episode. You just don't know. We've had some remarkable kinds of recoveries, and we continue to do, especially with all the new drugs that are out. But we not only have to do this, we have also a ministry to the families of the people who are dying of AIDS. And this includes their partners. Many times they're partners of many years. also includes their parents, who often come in from out of town, and their siblings, and so on. And we have some wonderful stories to tell about supportive parents, but we also have some absolutely awful stories to tell about what parents have done. Some parents have refused to come and see their children when they're dying, have written them off because they're gay, and literally, you know, say they don't care, you know, they deserve everything they get, and they have that attitude, and they will say it out loud to their children. Other parents will come and visit their children, their adult children in the hospital, but won't touch them. Even to shake their hand, hold their hand, or anything like this. And I will say that we have had parents who have come and done that, started out that way, and within a few days, they've been enlightened and have done a total conversion and turnaround. And it doesn't have anything to do with a person's age. We've had parents in their 60s who are absolute jerks. I mean, there's no other way to put it. And we've had people come in their 70s and 80s who knew nothing about this disease, and in 3-4 days learned a lot about it, and were open to doing that. And struggling with the whole fact of their children. It doesn't have anything to do with age. It doesn't have anything to do with politics. You have people who are conservative in their political thinking, who are absolutely wonderful in dealing with their children who have AIDS and with this whole thing. You have people who are liberal in their politics and are absolute jerks, you know, when it comes to dealing with the children. I mean, in other words, it crosses all the whole political spectrum. The biggest problem we have are with people who are Christians, you know, especially people who say that all of this is against God and so on like that. That's our biggest problem. Sometimes we have mothers and fathers both who. Sometimes we have mothers who are absolutely accepting and everything else, and fathers can't deal with it. Sometimes it's fathers who are absolutely accepting and mothers can't deal with it. Sometimes the parent can deal with it, parents can deal with it just fine, and there's the brothers and sisters have trouble. One sad story is a young man early on in the epidemic who was dying and who, when he was in high school, lost both of his parents. I forget exactly the circumstances of how he lost his parents, but he had to go and move in with his brother, older brother, and his wife, who were recently married when he finished high school, and that was his family. Then all through college and everything else, and he came to San Francisco and came out and contacted the AIDS virus, and. When he was dying, which took about a year and a half, 2 years, once his brother found out he had the disease, this young man was not welcome in his brother's home. His sister-in-law was afraid that her children would get AIDS, didn't want to hear anything about it, and so on like this. And when he was dying, his brother called. And Neil's partner was there, and I was there. And it wasn't Neil's partner because he had died previously. It was Neil's caregiver. Said, "I'm sorry, you're too late. He's gone." And that's exactly true. He called about 5 minutes too late. Then we have the situation where Pastor Hiller, one of our pastors, was ministering to. We got a call, and a young man was in the hospital and he was dying. We got a call from this young man's partner, and so Pastor Hiller was up and went up to the hospital, which we often get these calls. And people don't call for a minister until, you know, they're in dying stages. And this man lived about another week, and Michael was able to have some good pastoral discussions with him, and to prepare him spiritually for his death, and some good conversation with the partner. They had been together for 11 years. Well, when this young man died, his parents and one of his sisters, I think, came into town and totally ignored the partner and everything else like this, and started going through his stuff in his apartment and treated his partner of 11 years like he was a roommate or a tenant, somebody else, and just totally ignored what it was that he was going through, which is the same thing that a spouse goes through, and took his stuff and everything else like this. And while this young man was in grief and loss and was so vulnerable and did not have the strength to stand up to these folks, even though he had the documents that gave him power of attorney for health care and so on, which is really essential. We have a lot of that where families don't respect the relationships of gay people during this time. Another thing that we do is that I wanted to liturgically that I didn't mention is that we, in the prayers every Sunday, we always have people who are struggling with AIDS, people who are dying. We include time for that. Our assisting ministers who are lay people, both Jack and where's Barbara? She's not here. Okay. Talk about or serve as assisting ministers from time to time, and write the prayers, and they're always included. And sometimes we have people with AIDS tell their stories. In our cookbook, those people at that church, there's a testimony here by Michael Johnson and a few other people who are now dead of things that they said in church. The one by Michael is especially moving when he talks about hope. That is in here. Another thing that we do to respond is what we've done in the church is that we've created a caregivers group. And the caregivers are people who go to people with AIDS. They also go to other people in the church who have, if they have cancer or are aged. And do the things like getting them to the doctor, getting their medications, cleaning up in their house a little bit, being a friend. Sometimes people with this disease, because it goes on, become very isolated. And all of their friends, of course, are working. So you don't have people there just to do some of the ordinary things that need to be done. And they're not sick enough to be in the hospital, but they're not sick enough to take care of themselves. It's the same kind of thing you have with assisted living for seniors sometimes. The other thing is that in San Francisco, we have had a number of grassroots organizations that have grown up. We have an organization called Project Inform, and another organization called Stop AIDS. And these organizations have specific kinds of educational programs on how to prevent AIDS, what are the latest in medications, how to take care of yourself, how to do this regimen. In other words, they work in hand with the latest information from the medical profession and what services are available to people. We also have and have had for a long time a 24-hour hotline for AIDS. The church doesn't have this, but I mean, this is the thing that's available in the community. A very fine woman by the name of Ruth Brinker a few years ago started making nutritious meals in a church kitchen and got people to be involved in this. And that was the beginning of Project Open Hand. And what people do who volunteer for that is that they work in the kitchen. It kind of works like Holden a little bit. But the major volunteers, what they do is they deliver meals. So you get a hot meal delivered to your home every single day. It's a nutritious meal. It's designed specifically for people who have HIV and are on all these medications. And that has grown now to a huge organization, and with a, I think they have a budget of something like $11 million.
Yeah. Yeah, does, who provides the food then?
Project Open Hand, originally people donated the food. What Ruth did was that she went shopping. I mean, this is a woman who was, I mean, Ruth is close to 80 now, or she is 80 maybe, and she was in her late 60s when she started this. Wasn't she, Jen? Yeah. And so she got people to help her, and they got food donated from restaurants sometimes, and because you know we have one restaurant for every 75 people in San Francisco, so you have so she got food that way, and she but it had to be fresh, so she got friends to donate money to buy fresh produce and things like this. She started a project now called Fresh Start Farms, where on city lots, empty city lots around town, she has a homeless making vegetable gardens and so on. So she's done that in recent years. But so Project Open Hand is a very important function, and we get people that, do you know the number, Jack? How many meals they deliver every day? It's in the thousands.
Oh, yeah.
Thousands a day, yeah.
That's
something. Yeah. So, that's another grassroots organization. Then another one is the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, which is a very large, become a very large organization. They do a number of projects that they do, and they're also, they do education, they do fundraising, they raise, they're the primary beneficiaries of the San Francisco AIDS Walk, which is this coming Sunday, where there's a sign over there, you can help support it. Our congregation last year raised over $25,000 for the AIDS Walk, with about 80 walkers and about 900 sponsors. It was quite a thing. Another organization that is started is Kairos, which is an organization that was started by a former Catholic priest. Well, he isn't a former Catholic; he is a priest. And it was is for the caregivers, for the people who are caregivers, partners, hospice workers, family members. We've had a number of situations where, you know, mom has come out and stayed with her son until he died. Most often that's been a good thing. Sometimes it's been a very bad thing because sometimes mom isn't any better a mom when her child's been sick than she was when the kid was growing up. And, you know, that's true of all of us in our role as parents. So Kairos is an organization that helps people who are caregivers and people who are in grief after the loss of someone. And so that's specifically geared that way. We also have training for people who want to be caregivers or who are caregivers through Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Church. Jack has gone through that training, and about 15 people from our parish have gone through that training. It's an intensive weekend of about 40 hours, isn't it? Something like that, of intensive training about how to deal with people and how to be there for folks for this. And then our caregivers meet once a month to talk about their clients and to talk about what they're going through. Another grassroots organization started was Coming Home Hospice and Maitri Hospice. Coming Home Hospice was started through Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Parish, but then became a separate non-sectarian hospice, as did Maitri, which was started by the Buddhist Church. And is now remodeling a facility that's ready to open just a half a block from our church. And those are for people who are in the last stages. Now, with the protease inhibitors, we've had, if you can believe this, people are gone into hospice to die, because you're supposed to be, when you go into hospice, you're supposed to be, have no more than 6 months to live. And when you go to one of these hospices where people are dying of AIDS, where a couple of our members were in, it was always, are you going to see them again the next time you come to visit? And now we've had the phenomenon of people getting out of these hospice beds and walking home. It's not a cure, but it certainly lengthened people's lives. Finally, the medical systems in San Francisco are very much geared up to this, particularly our County General Hospital, which did the early work in treating people with AIDS, and the University of California San Francisco, which is our research medical school for the University of California system. And they have done an excellent job in caring for people at some of the private hospitals. So what we've done as a congregation are a few of the things that I've mentioned and that I mentioned earlier liturgically, and what we've done with our facility and what we've done to set up a caregivers group, and also what we have done then in networking with these other organizations to help people. Because many times what happens is that people with HIV come to San Francisco, come to the church because they know that wherever they live, they're not going to get the care that they get in San Francisco. The systems are not in place. So we have 16 years of living with this disease, and millions of dollars have been raised in voluntary contributions and millions more coming from government kinds of contracts and so on. Our congregation, as I mentioned, supports this also with the AIDS Walk, and also in our benevolence budget. We contribute every year to Project Open Hand. We contribute also to some of these other organizations. In the most further, we give quite a bit of support to the Most Holy Redeemer AIDS Support Group. Now, how does a congregation live with this? All this death and dying. And how does a pastor? I'd like to address the last question first. A priest friend of mine, Father Tony McGuire, who was at Most Holy Redeemer Church for quite a while, in the middle 1980s, was conducting his 10th funeral in about 6 weeks, and he just started to cry in the middle of the Mass. Just started to blubber and cry, and tried to pull himself together and couldn't. I remember about that same time getting ready to go out to dinner with a friend, and we were, it was kind of a joyous time. I think it was a Friday night, thank God it's Friday and all this kind of stuff. And we were talking about our week and things that had happened, and all of a sudden I just blurted out and said, they keep dying and there's no end in sight. And I started to cry. And I remember shouting that. So it was a mixture of anger. What I had to tell myself finally, that my experience as a pastor is not unique in dealing with all this death and dying. Because what I'm dealing with as a pastor is what pastors in previous generations dealt with every single day of their entire ministries. If I look at the church records of my church from the 1920s, there were young people dying left and right. There were women dying in childbirth. There were people dying from burst appendix. There were people dying from all kinds of things, because we did not have the medical advancements that we have now. And you folks here, some of you who are older than I am, or my age, will remember, as I do, as a kid, going to a lot of funerals with my parents of young people. I mean, they were my parents' age, which, of course, from my perspective as a child, was old. But these were people who were, you know, in their 30s and 40s, who died of various kinds of things.
Polio.
Yeah, and when I was a kid, polio was the big scare. The 5-year-old girl across the street and the 13-year-old boy next door both died of polio. And my parents were frightened. And of course, I was too stupid and invincible to know that could be me. You know how it felt. So that was a comfort to me, knowing that previous generations of pastors had dealt with a lot of death and a lot of unexpected death, as I have. And there were also a lot more accidents from machinery and things like that in those years. I also told myself what the scripture says, and at every funeral, the four of us got into the habit of reading the entire chapter of 1 Corinthians 15. Now, usually what happens is this is a long, long chapter in Paul's letter to the Corinthians about what happens to, what's the resurrection about. And I think it goes on for some 60-some verses. But I remember saying at this one funeral, we were talking about what scriptures to read. I said, Michael, why don't you read something from 1 Corinthians 15? And he started reading, and there was no place to stop. So he read the whole chapter. And we kind of have continued to do that. So there's a constant affirmation of the resurrection. And then there is the importance of ritual. We do a big thing on All Saints Day. We read all the names. 2 years ago, we read 500 names in the service. And we do it with groups, usually 10. We did a scroll that was over the entire top of the sanctuary with all these names on them, written on them. It was just a paper scroll that one of the pastors did. Transfiguration, Christmas Eve, we bring it up. The memorial services, we work out the memorial services with the partners, with the people who are survivors, to try to make it a source of comfort for them. Many times, of course, the memorial service, we're dealing with people who are not Christian, many partners who are not Christian. We talk it out in our groups. What we do as pastors is that we go on retreat, just the four of us, twice a year. And we pray a lot and pray for each other and talk about some of the things that we're experiencing. Some of the difficult part of the people who are in the choir, like my wife, Diane, and our choir director has been very ill a number of times, and we're always worried about that. We right now have two members of our church council who have AIDS, full-blown AIDS. I remember when Jim Berg was our treasurer, who died in 1992, we wanted to give him a thanks. He could no longer function as our treasurer because he was just too sick. And so we gave him a nice plaque, and the church council in the middle of the meeting got up and walked 3 blocks to the hospital and presented Jim with this plaque. And it was very moving, not only for him, but for us. The interesting thing that happens is that in living with this is that on our council retreat this year, our church council retreat, Bruce and Grant, both of whom have serious HIV or serious AIDS, full-blown AIDS, and have been up and down many times and near death many times. So it came time for their medical regimen, which they have to do every few hours, and they pull in the IVs, and they go around with this, and they have a permanent shunt in their arm. And so while we're sitting there talking about the business of the council retreat, they're you know, sticking needles in to the shunt and starting the IVs. And they said, just keep talking. So we just keep dealing with the business while these guys are doing this kind of thing. So it is a thing where you have to continue to affirm life in the midst of death. What we receive from people with AIDS is a powerful witness. One of the things, of course, that most of us are familiar with is saying there are no atheists in foxholes. And the reason for that is that most of us as human beings are not naturally profound. We have to be forced into it. You know, we have to be forced into dealing with these kinds of issues. And when you're 30 years old or 40 years old, you do not have to deal in your mind. You're not dealing with, you know, Social Security, let alone death. I mean, you're not thinking about how much am I going to get for my pension like I am now. But you're thinking about, you know, you're thinking about the day-to-day and the advancement in your career and everything else. So you have to, what happens is that people who are dying have a profound sense of a perspective, and the things of their faith come rising forth, and the things that they say and the way that they act, especially if they've been raised in the faith, are absolutely marvelous to listen to and are very faith-strengthening. So we receive. Also, as a congregation, we carry out a ministry of caring. I think with our caregivers group, for people with AIDS, our pastoral care, Pastor Zilhart devotes almost all of her time to dealing with people who are sick or dying. She's for pastoral care. The other thing we've done is that we have created a St. Francis Foundation a few years ago, so people can bequeath their assets after they have died to the church, and the income from that will continue to support the ministry for the church, but the amount whatever it is that they give remains. It is not spent. And so our foundation now has assets of nearly $600,000, and we use 40% of the income from that foundation for the ministry of St. Francis, and 60% goes to outside benevolence kinds of things, both in the community and nationwide. The other thing is that we here just a month ago adopted a capital fund campaign for $600,000 to build, among other things, a memorial garden terrace in which people's ashes can be interred. We have a small, very small plot of land right next to the church. We only have two lots in the middle of the city. But there's a very small plot of land that will have memorial stones and squares, and we can inter ashes there. So people have a sense that when they have the comfort of knowing that when they die, their remains will be right there next to their church. In many cases, the only family they've ever had. So we have hope today. I think we have been given a temporary reprieve with these new drugs, but it's too early to hope that this is going to be the end of this terrible epidemic. The other thing is that only about half the people can tolerate this regimen of drugs. I mean, these are pretty heavy toxins that people are infusing into their bodies to stay alive. Okay, I'll take questions. What time are we supposed to be finished? Another 15 minutes? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to ask a question, and it's this. In your concern for the AIDS people, do you still have time for the other people in your congregation?
Very good question. Yes. We do. Having four pastors really is helpful in that way. But we do keep contact when people are missing from church for any period of time and so on. And we obviously, when anybody has any other kind of a problem, which of course, like in any congregation, comes up, why we're available for people to deal with. That's one of the reasons that we need as many staff as we do. Even though we are a congregation of only 160 members, we have 2 full-time pastors and 2 part-time pastors.
How do you get money to support that?
Come to my session tomorrow.
Okay. Well, did you say you went there in 1981?
Yes.
What was your response when you found that this is going to be the place where so much of the AIDS was really a part of their...
Well, it just grew gradually, but then it kind of exploded in the middle 80s. And I mean, that was not part of our discussion in the summer of 1981.
I just meant, how did you respond to that within yourself, that here I am in the setting of, this?
Well, that's what I alluded to before. One thing, I was thankful that I was not a 25-year-old pastor. And the other thing was that I felt the heritage, if you will, of previous generations of pastors who had to deal with a lot of death. I mean, where that was what they did all the time with all of the epidemics that came from typhoid and where there weren't any cures for. So I think I did that. I mean, plus my own faith, and then we always have each other, In a church community, we always have each other. Yeah. Yes.
Have you had to have, classes or seminars for your own members to accept all this? I mean, or has it all been just accepted real
well? We've all had to do it together. You see, the other thing is that straight folks are experiencing this not only in their church, but also where they work. Because, I mean, gay people are everywhere, and everybody works with people who are out, and people work, hand in hand with people, co-workers who are dying. And sometimes they are gone, and then they come back, and there's this kind of thing.
We're from the Midwest, and it kind of blows my mind, don't have as much, we have had a person with AIDS in our congregation.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard for the people to accept how to cope with it. You say they were scared, they didn't want to touch, they didn't want
to. Yeah, go ahead, Jack, yeah.
I got into the whole program because of a personal friend who I worked with. And I was a teacher, and he was a teacher in our school. And he came out to me, and he had AIDS. We were very, very close. And in fact, he introduced me to my wife. And I joined St. Francis, really, to bring him to church. He wouldn't come. He had been so turned off by previous rejection, he just wouldn't come. And I was scared. I was scared to death. I didn't know what to expect from this. I got some education. That's the first thing. I wasn't afraid to hug my friend. Somehow I don't think an expression of love will be punishment or will be deadly. I just can't believe that. And anyway, I went through the training that Jim talked about, which was profound. It's amazing training. Everyone should go through it just to learn how to deal with your own problems with death and dying. And it took me about 2 years to not be afraid anymore. You have to almost want to get AIDS. It's very hard to get it. And the education, I think, is the most important thing. And knowing people personally. You know, for many of us, for many years, for me, gay people were over there doing that weird thing. And it took a long time for me to change my mind on that. And it changed really when I met Pat, when I met my friend. I knew him for 5 years before I even knew he was gay.
I just because your comment about people, you know, from the Midwest and not having as much of that. When I'm a physical therapist, and so I deal in the medical community, and I remember it's about the same time you were heading to St. Francis. They did a program on people with AIDS, and they did I'm from Eastern Washington, and it was, how are we going to deal with this epidemic in the Palouse? Well, 2 years later, we looked at it again and said there was no epidemic in the Palouse. And the reason was, they surmised that the reason was that children didn't come home, because they didn't come home to the small conservative communities where their families were, because they didn't feel they could have the support there. So they did, they went to San Francisco and they went to Seattle, and we've never had to deal with that as a medical issue in our small conservative communities. So I think it's really interesting that people gravitate away from their home and they find homes other places because of the lack of acceptance. And it's not the status of the disease, it's the status of the number of people that have the disease that are gays or lesbians.
I was the director of nursing at a state psychiatric hospital when this whole thing of AIDS came up, and we were really terrified because we didn't know what we were dealing with. We didn't know how much we were going to deal with it. And then they told us to act as if everyone had AIDS, and so we were, you know, overreacting. Mm-hmm. But we didn't, you know, this is part of the learning process and trying to figure out what was going on. And then we started getting a few AIDS patients. We never did get very many in the 14 years I was there. But the nursing staff got so attached to the patients and wanted to keep them while they died, but then this was not appropriate for our hospital. We didn't have the facility, so they had to let them go. And there was a real grieving process. So we came full circle.
Visiting Nurses in Hospice has a memorial service every year at our church in the first Monday in December. It is, and they have for years. And these are for the nurses and caregivers who have lost patients, and they come up, and there's a long, the reading of names of all who have died in the past year, and the nurses come up, and as that person's name is read, and light a candle and place it up there, and the whole chancel is ablaze, and the church is packed. And the service goes on for about 2.5 hours. I mean, and there's a lot of grieving, and the families are invited too. And it's not just people with AIDS have died. There's people also with cancer and those kinds of things. But it's primarily people with AIDS, because that's been our experience. But that's the very thing, and there are structures for that. I have been very impressed with the medical response of the medical profession in our city and the people. I mean, but like you said, they went through the same exact thing in the early years, like you went through in your hospital. What do we do with this? And there had to be some real fast education.
Oh, yeah.
The problem was is that they didn't know that much about it. Yeah.
We were in constant contact with the San Francisco people, so we knew what to teach because they were far ahead of us.
Yeah, they were aggressive. Paul Wolberding, who is one of the real pioneer researchers, is a Lutheran from a little town in southern Minnesota, and he and his wife, Amali, both of whom are physicians and are on the faculty at the University of San Francisco, And Molly is on the board of Project Open Hand. But we can't get them to come to church, even though they're Lutheran. They're too busy, I guess.
You know, medically, I keep saying this, but I think that the irony behind AIDS research and AIDS education is, number one, we've never had a disease that's been so culturally aware. It has created an awareness that we don't have any other disease. I think part of that's because there's so many artistically talented people that have AIDS, so Hollywood is involved.
Right.
But to me, there is going to be some justice somehow, because I think that the cure for cancer is going to be found in AIDS research. And I think, to me, there's kind of a gentle justice in that whole judgmental thing that goes along with AIDS that doesn't accompany other diseases like cancer. And I think it would be wonderful if the disease of cancer, you know, the cure for cancer could be found in AIDS research.
In this country, you know, we're further along, but, you know, trying to do anything, like, for example, we had a project, because we've been involved in the sanctuary movements in El Salvador in the early 80s, the middle 1980s, and when the Civil War was going on down there, one of the things that happened is that one of our young men got down there, and was the fact that there was no AIDS education. So he and one of his friends started just distributing condoms on the streets in El Salvador, in San Salvador, and they had to get out of the country because they were threatened, you know, by death squads. I mean, it's just awful. And they still won't do it. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, the World Health Organization, countries like Uganda and Tanzania and the whole part of South Central Africa, you know, whole villages, I mean, millions of people have died, and it's all, it's heterosexual. It's a heterosexual disease, and that's where most of the diseases, and it's a rapidly growing disease in Southeast Asia, Thailand, and so on, a place like that. It's primarily heterosexual.
Are they dealing with it in Africa? Do they have programs?
They're trying, but you know, those countries are so impoverished.
Yeah.
And still moving out of a tribal society in many ways, and it is really, really difficult. I mean, poverty is just overwhelming.
Yes, there's also a theory about where AIDS came from, and I don't know how correct it is, but there's a theory that it actually started in America, that there was a vaccine, they were working on a vaccine for smallpox, and they were working in bovine research, and that they didn't want to try the vaccine out here, so they sent it to Africa, to a third world country, and that's actually where.
But that's part of the mythology, mm-hmm. and you hear there in the African American community, they will talk about that AIDS is a plot by the CIA and the FBI to wipe out the black population in this country. I mean, there are those kinds of theories, huh?
Too many people believe it.
Yeah, and there's too many people believe that.
Oh yeah,
there's a missionary physician in the 1950s that died of AIDS in Africa. Central country of Africa, and that's documented. And they, with all of the symptoms that she had and so on, like this, and however she got this from blood or something, that, but that she had all the symptoms and died of this disease, and so the virus was there then. But what's happened now with the global world, you know, you can transport anything 24 hours into this country and all over, somebody, you know, coming out of those countries, you know.
And that's what happened,
I think. That's what they.
Do you think it had to do with that? I remember, I think 60 Minutes or something had a
airline.
About the airline steward.
Yeah, that he infected everybody. He was a French Canadian, golden boy, you know, that did this. Yeah. Who knows? You know, I mean, there are a number of people that were responsible for spreading the disease. I mean, you want to blame it on individuals, but part of the thing was that was that in the late 70s, I moved to San Francisco in 1978, and Jack was living already. There was a real immature, if you will, candy store mentality in the Castro. I mean, it was stuff going on. I mean, just out of the whole sense of freedom. It's kind of like the thing that you would have is that people who are in the closet about their sexuality, you know, about being gay. If they come out at 25 years old, it's like a heterosexual kid coming out at 14 years old and discovering girls, you know, or girls at 12, 13 year old girls discovering boys. We talk about girls at that age sometimes being boy crazy. Well, if that happens to you at 25 or 30, you know, and we're dealing with a pastor right now who's coming out at 52 years old. And it's like dealing with a teenager. He's been repressed for so long. You find some of the same thing in the 1960s when religious sisters, you know, nuns came out of the convent and felt free to explore for the first time in their lives their sexuality. Some of those kinds of things, some of those same kinds of things went on.
They're too old to have parents to try to control them and keep limits.
Right, and to talk to about. You know, not only that, it's. So what AIDS has done is it caused a great deal of maturity and consciousness of the gay community. I mean, you have committed relationships that were people had been together for a while. You know, all of a sudden there's no sex in this relationship because one person is ill, and they have to reevaluate about that, as do heterosexual couples when one person gets ill. You know. And how long does that go on? And so, you know, what happened was that relationships were explored on the basis of the quality of their relationships and not on the basis of sexual attraction. And many of them are very, very solid. I mean, we find that. I mean, some people break up, just like happens in heterosexual marriages. You know, one person gets sick and the other one can't deal with it and takes off. You know, it's the same thing that happens, yeah.
Did you have your question answered?
Well, I think so, kind of, in a way.
Do you have a chance to see Angels in America? So, play dealing with AIDS. So,
what's it called, sir?
Angels in America.
It's been on tour.
It's won awards everywhere. Wherever it's from.
Yeah, it won all the Tony Awards.
It started in San Francisco.
The question of how the churches, I think she asked how they support four pastors with 160 members. And that's going through my mind.
You'll come back.
We had one pastor, one and a half, and we had financial trouble at all.
Well, you come tomorrow. Is it tomorrow at 6:20 that I'm dealing, I think the title is Old Buildings. Old buildings, many needs, few resources. How do we hold it all together? I'll talk about that tomorrow.
Was there something just recently in the paper about someone who contacted AIDS from kissing or something?
Yeah, that happened. Since I left home a week ago or a week and a half ago, that they thought maybe it was a couple. One of them had AIDS,
but they had
gum disease.
Yes,
both of them had gum disease, and they figured it could have happened that way because they felt that they were taking proper precautions.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing as that where you will sometimes have medical people who are wearing latex gloves and are handling a needle and it penetrates the glove and they just that little bit and they get infected with the blood. And that's happened a couple of times. And then there was this young woman, I remember a few years ago, who went to a dentist who had AIDS and got AIDS. She was.
But the, you know, you look at the percentages of those, and
so few.
And I mean, you go through training in a hospital, you don't even put a cap on a needle by holding one and the other anymore. That cap for that needle is down, so you don't even touch it. You don't even touch it until the needle's in it. I mean, we are taught so many precautions that you would really have to make a pretty gigantic mistake to. But within the medical community,
yeah.
So people in the, you know, outside of that community, but it's fearful. People are afraid. I had a patient that started a swimming program for her back, and she had been pain-free for 12 years after having pain for 15 years. And the minute the AIDS scare started, she stopped swimming because she thought she was going to get AIDS, and she went back to having her back problems again. But, I mean, with all that came out at that time, the Surgeon General was saying.
Yeah.
Are they doing a good job in the schools? I came through the teaching profession, and I just wonder.
Yeah.
You know,
I think they do some of it in the schools in San Francisco, but
pretty scared of it usually because
yeah.
You have to deal with homosexuality and that's.
We have a there's a piece in the kids have in their program in San Francisco schools, but you know the overwhelming problem with the kids in San Francisco schools is not AIDS, it's drugs. I mean, it's drugs and violence,
just. AIDS is just related to drugs.
It's drugs, so you can certainly talk about.
Yes.
Well, in our state of Washington schools right now, there's a group that is putting books in the libraries and in the school libraries too, which really, is really telling the kids, well, it's all right. Dad's got a boyfriend, and you can go and live with them, and mm-hmm. and all of this stuff. And there's a group in the Western Slopes anyway. I can't think of the name of it right now, but they've been fighting that extensively because they said this isn't good for children too. They're trying to explain it, but they're explaining it in a way that is pushing the idea of homosexuality.
Well, yeah, but you can't, I mean, there's not, you can't really, I mean, push something. What it is trying to shed some light on what has been in darkness. And the reality is that some children are obviously going to have gay parents. And how do children learn those kinds of differences?
I know, but is that any reason for really pushing it down the throats of the 90% of the kids who don't have that type of thing?
Can I say something?
Jack, yeah.
I was a teacher. I'm a retired school teacher. And I had kindergarten kids who were fully aware of what AIDS was through education.
I'm not talking about AIDS.
We have to talk about AIDS. If we don't, people are going to die. And many of the kids knew about it before I ever even talked about it and brought it up themselves. Mm-hmm. Who had friends whose fathers died, or friends whose uncles died, or their uncle died. Mm-hmm. So you have to discuss it.
And well, you have to discuss homosexuality. You have to talk about it, the fact that some people, I mean, it was the same thing years ago, is that you didn't talk about divorce. The only way, I mean, children were instructed not to talk about dad who left mom. He's never to be mentioned again in this house.
Oh, well, that's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous. Well, it's also ridiculous to say that you can't talk about dad who is gay.
Well, I still don't believe in having all of these books in the school library, because really what it is doing to the kids, it's showing them that this is a way of life. It's
it
not
is.
Too bad.
It is. It is a way of life.
Partner is,
it's a part, it's a normal.
He'll do this for you.
It is a way of life.
It is a way of life.
It is a way of life.
I'm still opposed to it.
Well, nobody's taking those children and pushing them into the library and saying, you must read this book and agree. The books are there. It's the same, you know. It's like any other book. I mean, there's a lot of things that are... I mean, I don't have to read books that frighten me. I don't have to read books that, you know, that I don't want to read. That's a freedom that I have to choose. But if you don't, if you think the reality of homosexuality is not there, then you're not dealing with the reality of the world.
I think they're making it, too. They're making it into a beautiful relationship that the kids should enjoy.
It is a beautiful relationship.
But they're not going to choose that. Just like, for example, people will not. I mean, there are all kinds of people. I'm sure when you were a young woman, that you wouldn't think of marrying or even dating if they asked you. And that's true also when it comes to people of the same gender. People who are homosexual are not going to recruit someone, or not wanting to do anything else. What they want to do is to find people. They want to find people that to whom they are attracted and who are attracted to them.
And well, that, you have your opinion and I have mine, and I'm going to fight against it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think we have to stop, even though there's not a bell.